130 million years ago, a very violent astrophysical event took place about 130 million light years away from us. And we just received that signal here last year, and a new era in astronomy has been born. Two neutron stars merged together in a very violent cataclysmic event, sending out gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves as well. And we were finally in position to be able to observe both of these kinds of waves. Thank you. Arnold knows I'm a little tall. Thank you, Arnold. Okay, good. Thanks. All right. Multi-messenger astronomy is now the word that's being used to describe astronomy today, because we're now able to use gravitational waves observatories like LIGO and Virgo. LIGO is the combined interferometers in the United States, one just south of here in Hanford, Washington, and the other one near where I am in Texas, Livingston, Louisiana. These are two several kilometer long interferometers that are used to detect gravitational waves. The Virgo Observatory just came online this last year and joined its combined effect with the LIGO observatories to give us the ability to not only detect gravitational waves, but to localize them to where they're coming from in space. What are sources of gravitational waves? Well, anytime you accelerate mass, general relativity predicts that you will get gravitational waves being emitted. One of the best examples of this would be a rapidly orbiting binary system of two neutron stars, or pulsars. In fact, the Nobel Prize given to Taylor and Halsey in 1993 was because two neutron stars orbiting each other were decaying in their orbit via the emission of gravitational waves. And over a several decade period, we were able to see the effect of the orbital decay, and it matched the predictions of general relativity perfectly. So it was an indirect, if you will, an indirect way to infer that gravitational waves were being emitted because the orbital decay of these neutron stars were taking place. However, if you want stronger gravitational waves, you need much more violent activity. And the gravitational wave strength and frequency would be greatly increased as the binary system comes closer together and approaches a merger. Here's an optical simulation of two black holes, binary black holes that are almost in the process of merging right now. This represents the gravitational waves that are being emitted by the black holes right before their merger, the ripples in space-time that are moving outward from them. And in fact, and Arnold gave a talk at the ASA meeting here a couple of years ago on the discovery of gravitational waves. The very first discovery was made on September 14, 2015, of two merging black holes of a binary system over a billion light years away. And that signal traveling all the way to us was extremely weak. In fact, the LIGO Observatory had to detect small variations in the stretching of space, 1/1000th the diameter of a proton. 1/1000th the diameter of a proton. That's how sensitive the gravitational wave detectors had to be. But these were observed in LIGO, both the Livingston and the Hanford LIGO observatories on September 14, 2015. And it matched the predictions of general relativity perfectly. However, no optical signals were given by merging binary black holes, only gravitational waves. What would be more interesting to the astronomical community would be the merging of neutron stars. Why? Because they give off not only gravitational waves, but electromagnetic waves as well. Electromagnetic waves can escape from neutron stars and not black holes. And so that was the next thing that was looked for. And there were five observations of merging binary black holes before August 17, 2017. The astronomical community was all abuzz, but they kept it secret from the rest of us until the word leaked out a little later that a new discovery had been made. And I'm going to describe this together with you. The gravitational wave observatories, Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo, all observe gravitational waves. But the gravitational waves they observed were distinctively different from the previous ones that were made by merging black holes. It was observed over a longer time period, a more gradual decay, and the frequency never got as high as in the merging binary black holes. And so it suggested the merging of a lighter system. 1.7 seconds after the gravitational wave observatories detected their signals, the Fermi Gamma Space Telescope observed a gamma ray burst. It was a weak gamma ray burst, but it was nonetheless very clear. 1.7 seconds later, could they be coming from the same event? They were both able to localize the direction of the sky from where it was coming from, and they both overlapped to the same region of the sky. And so you see that the region of the sky was actually pinpointed better by the LIGO-Virgo combined detectors to being a very just 30 square degrees of the sky, very narrow region, but it overlapped with the Fermi quite well. So we knew that they were probably the source of the same event. So we are now in the era of the multi-messenger astronomy, not just electromagnetic waves, but also gravitational waves in concert to give you a combined source of looking at the same event. So it was a cute little cartoon here describing how both the gravitational wave observatories and the gamma ray telescope observe the same event in different waves. But it took a while before any optical telescopes could find this event. Even narrowing it down to 30 square degrees of the sky is still a large region of the sky to investigate and try to localize something that is 130 million light years away. The SWOPE telescope in Chile was the first one to actually find the source, a visible light source coming from the galaxy NGC 4993, and this was a little over 10 hours after the discoveries had been made by the LIGO, Virgo, and the Fermi telescope. It was found to be in the same region of the sky, and a new light source was seen in this NGC 4993 that hadn't been seen before. Here you see this bluish light source that had not been observed before in this galaxy showing up on this date. And it very, over the next couple of weeks, it dimmed and reddened. I'm going to describe that a little bit more, how that dimming and that reddening tells us a little bit more about what's going on inside that event. So the accompanying light signals, in addition to the lengthy signals that were received in the gravitational wave detectors, strongly suggested the merging of a binary system of two neutron stars. And this is what we call a kilonova. Now, many ground-based observatories then got in on the act. Once it was discovered where the light source was coming from, they had to work in tandem. And this is another new thing that has been taking place in the astronomy community. All of these observatories are very rapidly in contact with each other and work and coordinating their work together. And so many different, in total, over 70 different telescopes were involved in observing the light coming from this event. And so this is a general light curve coming from this event that brightened and was very blue and then began to dim over a couple of days and grow redder and redder and redder. And this reddish signal, this reddish portion tells us a little bit about the production of heavy elements taking place in this event. Now, you might suspect that modeling something like this would be extremely complex, and it is, because it involves so many branches of extreme physics. You have to use general relativity, you have to use nuclear physics, you have to use atomic physics, you have to use equations of hydrodynamics, Navier-Stokes equation. You have to combine in your model many different factors, and some of them are actually very difficult to model. And it's ironic that the very difficult to solve equations of general relativity become the most accurate and the surest signal that's coming out of this event, because it's the one that's the least complicated. The gravitational waves that are being produced and can be predicted by general relativity do not experience the complexities of all the other things that you're going to see in this model. Now, this model, you see the binary neutron stars orbiting each other rapidly. The gravitational waves are represented, being given off, and the frequency increases right up to the merger of over 250 hertz, 250 times a second that they're orbiting around each other right before they merge. And this, they're moving about one-third the speed of light right before they touch. And in the process of merging, I'm going to play that again. It was a little bit too fast. And the whole thing does take place a little bit too fast for us to really talk about much. But here is the simulation of the kilonova event, the two binary stars orbiting faster and faster and faster, 250 times a second, right before they touch. And then two jets come out. And the jets are constraining, the charged particles are constrained to come out by the magnetic field into two jets. And those are the gamma ray bursts that we see. And it was a gamma ray burst that was actually very weak for the Fermi telescope to pick up. And we believe it was because we were not looking along one of the axes. We were kind of looking off to the side of one of those jets. And that's why it was a weaker gravitational or gamma ray burst. And then this growing cloud of matter, this is where the nucleosynthesis of heavier elements is taking place, in this shell of matter that's being expelled. Now, most of the matter, the vast majority of the matter stays together in a larger either neutron star or black hole. And there's a little bit of confusion as right now as to what the final product really is. Is it orbiting fast enough that it's still a massive neutron star, or is it now a black hole that no light is coming out of? That's a little bit difficult to model, but a few hundredths of the matter, a few hundredths of the entire matter is expelled in this event. And this is where the production of heavier elements is taking place in this growing expansion, the cloud of matter. It's being heated, and there's a large source of free neutrons. And so this is a primary place where the R process nucleosynthesis is taking place to build up heavier and heavier elements. So the kilonova is the site of a favorite site of the R process, the rapid process of nucleosynthesis, where neutrons are being captured at a faster rate than it can beta decay back to the curve of stability on this nuclear chart here. The chart of the nuclei here, you see the curve of stability of stable nuclei represented by the black ones. These are the elements that are actually being built up by the R process that are very neutron rich. They're extremely neutron rich and very unstable, but they're capturing neutrons at a rate faster than they can beta decay back to the curve of stability. Here are the drip lines at a mass number of 82, or neutron number of 82, and 126, these sort of magic numbers that are very highly stable, and forming a drip line in which you can't capture more neutrons, but you can certainly capture more protons and build up to a point where these would then beta decay back to the curve of stability, leaving you abundance of elements in these areas of the chart of nuclei. And that's how we know that the R process is responsible for building up much of the heavier elements, heavier than iron. Now, why is this favored over supernovae for heavy element production, like the heaviest elements? Well, supernovae have huge problems in trying to build up heavy elements via the R process. Over 99% of the energy is emitted via the form of neutrinos, which has trouble heating up the temperature high enough of that expanding cloud of gas coming out of the supernova. And the neutron densities are much, much greater here on the near the surface of two merging neutron stars. So there's a huge advantage in the production of heavy elements coming from a kilonova as opposed to a supernova. So now we actually believe that elements heavier than iron, much of the elements that are heavier than iron, were actually produced via the merging of neutron stars. Now, the two lightest elements we know were produced in the Big Bang, hydrogen and helium. And then, of course, the nucleosynthesis burning process inside the core of stars build up heavier and heavier elements. But like we've heard before, all the way up to iron, you get energy coming out, but after that you don't. And so the production of elements heavier than iron is greatly limited by this. And so the question has been for astronomers, where do those heavier elements come from? How do you get the R process to build up those heavier elements beyond iron? And it was assumed that perhaps supernovae would be the favored site somehow, some way, of building up the heavier elements. But there's several factors that we know today that limit the production of heavy elements via supernovae. So kilonovae, this is our favored source of the heavy elements. How much gold is produced in one of these events? Well, its model suggests that up to 200 Earth masses of gold is produced in one kilonova event, and 500 Earth masses of platinum is produced in one kilonova event. So if you're wearing gold on your finger, in the form of a ring, it probably came from a kilonova event sometime in the past. Okay. Another exciting development of kilonova research is the ability to use the strength of the gravitational wave to actually infer a distance, to infer how far away that event must have taken place based upon the strength of the gravitational wave coming to us. Can we use that then to get an independent check on the expansion rate of the universe, the Hubble constant? And the answer is yes. But it's a little tricky because 130 million light years is actually not very far away. It's actually, this is one reason why the gravitational wave detectors are in the process of being equipped to be much more sensitive right now. They're not running right now. They're being upgraded so that they can detect kilonova events from much further away than, say, 130 million light years. So we were actually very lucky to observe something as close as 130 million light years away. And the greatest uncertainty in trying to derive a value for the Hubble constant from this turns out to be the local effects of motion and trying to use the Doppler shift of this galaxy, NGC 4993, to get its motion, its expansion rate away from us, and trying to correct from local effects becomes the greatest uncertainty bit. Even so, you can use this to derive a value for the Hubble constant. And it turns out to be quite consistent, of course, with the values that we get from values that we get from looking at the cosmic microwave background radiation, the Planck, and the WMAP data is actually a little bit different from what we get from looking at type 1A supernovae using, say, the Hubble telescope, looking at type 1A supernovae and trying to derive a value for the Hubble constant from that. There's actually a little bit of discrepancy between those two different ways of getting the Hubble constant right now. And this one just happens to fall right in between both of them, but there's still quite a bit of spread. So the hope is that we'll use kilonova events in future years to get a more exact value for the Hubble constant. In conclusion, kilonova and multi-messenger astronomy represent a new era in astronomy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lots of time for questions.
Maybe I missed it, but did you mention anything about neutrinos being detected in accordance with for example, the LIGO event or this event?
I don't think any neutrinos were detected in association with this event. All I'm aware of are the gravitational wave detectors and all of the electromagnetic wave detectors, including the space-based and ground-based observatories. But I'm not familiar with any neutrino detection associated with it.
So they were asked, and they did a search, and they didn't find anything at the time when it arrived?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. None were detected. Yeah, this is not a good source of neutrinos from this, but certainly gravitational waves.
Yes, I came in a minute or two late, so I may have missed a definition. You talk about the R process.
R process, right? Yes.
Could you explain that for me one more time?
Yeah, the R process is the rapid process of neutron capture. That's the way that we believe that the heavier elements were built up is via capturing. It's too hard to capture protons because they're repelled by the Coulomb force. But if you capture neutrons can build up to heavier and heavier masses, but you're far from the curve of stability. And so beta decay brings you back to the curve of stability. And so the R process of building up heavier elements is by capturing neutrons. And then beta decay brings you back to somewhere on the curve of stability.
As opposed to what?
The S process is the slow process, where it's a slow process of neutron capture in which you stay on the curve of stability by slowly capturing neutrons, and beta decay takes place fast enough to keep you on the curve of stability. But we know that the heaviest elements were not produced primarily via the S process. We know it was the R process.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, very, very good talk. Are the models at the point where they can predict the relative abundance of the heavy elements that are produced? How much gold, how much platinum, how much, you know, uranium, et cetera, how many rare earths?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've tried to fight with understanding these models quite a bit, and that's where the complexity really comes in the models, because so many factors are actually required in your model, and there's some uncertainty in many of these factors. But the reddening that you see in the light curve is a strong indicator that lanthanide series elements are being produced in the kilonova event. The fact that it stayed bright enough to see and reddish for a couple weeks after the event was like a smoking gun telling us that there were lanthanide series heavy elements being produced in this event. And so the observation alone, don't worry about the models, how accurate the models are. The observations alone tell us that there were heavy elements being produced in the kilonova event.
No, I'm not disputing that at all. Right. I want to know how, you know, now I'm a theorist. I want to compare theory to experiment, and we should be able to predict the relative abundances of all these things. It might be hard, but that seems to me to be the job now of theory, is how much stuff do you get? And the other that would come out is we should be able to produce, or these things presumably would produce, unstable elements heavier than uranium. Is there any evidence they do?
Good questions. The relative abundance of isotopes, as far as I understand, that are being produced in events like the R process, tend to favor certain isotopes because of those drip lines that you see. You tend to get beta decaying back to certain isotopes on the curve of stability. So those abundances are actually a little bit skewed, and theoretically they should be skewed. And that's how we know that it's the R process that's producing these elements. But I can't answer your question about elements heavier than, say, uranium. But certainly a lot of unstable elements are being produced, but they're eventually going to decay back to somewhere on that curve of stability. Yes.
We might see
something. That's a good question, Robert. I really don't know how to answer your question any better.
No? For clarification, when you said lanthanides, are these fission products of spontaneous fission produced from the heavy elements? Is that what you mean? You said high production of lanthanides.
Yeah, lanthanides, anything heavier than lanthanum on the periodic table. Let me go back, if I can, just a moment. Oops, went too far. Yeah, where are your lanthanide series here? There's lanthanum right there, element 57. So anything heavier than that, all the way up to gold, platinum, and these elements here. So all of these elements are the lanthanum and above, where we believe the R process inside of merging neutron stars is the primary place where these are being manufactured. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. Well, what about, is there any evidence specifically from spontaneous fission of the super heavy elements?
Right. Fission is not going to be your primary means. It's going to be beta decay bringing you back to somewhere on the curve of stability somewhere. That's going to be the primary thing that's going to take place here. Fissionable elements are actually pretty rare.
Okay. Well, let's thank our speaker one last time.